Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to the people from the Española Valley Humane Society. Robert Knott will not be with us speaking of the arts. He'll be back next week. I'm happy now to welcome Emily Kaltenbach. She is with the Aging and Long-Term Services Department of the State of New Mexico and is here to talk to us about a new initiative. It's called the Elder Economic Security Initiative. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Thanks for letting me join you.
So one of the things, and we talk about a lot of people who are invisible to the rest of us, and our elders are often an invisible community of people who are having real problems, not only health problems, but serious economic problems.
Yeah, absolutely. New Mexico, the number of elders in New Mexico is actually going to be growing over the next couple of decades. Currently, we have around 14% of our residents over the age of 65. By 2020, 2030, that's going to be growing. And ultimately, by 2030, we're going to have 26% of our elders over the age of 65. So that's a huge growth. And so New Mexico needs to prepare for the change in demographics. And so one of the Elder Economic Security Initiative is focusing on how do we keep people in their home, in their community, if that's what they wish, and how do we measure their economic security.
And so how do we measure their economic security? What is the situation like right now for our elders?
Well, what we know is that about 17% of our elders live below the poverty level.
And, you know, I have to say, let's just stop for a second. Below the poverty level, above the poverty level is set really, really low. I mean, even if you're two or three times the poverty level, I don't know how anyone can live.
So happy you brought that up, because part of this initiative is actually developing a new index to measure economic well-being instead of deprivation. Because the federal poverty level, which is a fairly outdated measure, only took into account food. So the federal government assumed that everyone paid about a third of their income on food and multiplied it by three. So currently, for one person, the federal poverty level is about $10,800.
Right.
A year.
Now, that is less than $1,000 a month. Try living on that under any circumstances in the state of New Mexico, or in the city of Santa Fe, New Mexico. If you're an elderly person, you're not going to stack up two, three, four people in a one-bedroom apartment.
Right. And so we never took into account what the cost for housing is, what the cost of transportation is, miscellaneous costs. What about the cleaning supplies or the clothing?
And as utilities, telephone,
healthcare costs. Even if you're in good health, you're paying for your Part B premium every month under Medicare and your prescription drug premium. So those add up. And what we've done is looked county by county to see what would an elder need to be able to stay in their home and be economically secure.
And so what did you find?
Well, on average, what we found, and it still sounds like a low number, but that on average, if you are a single person and you rent, it's about $17,000 a year that you would need. And
that still sounds pretty low.
It still sounds low. Now, if you're in good health, that's assuming good health. If you're needing some kind of in-home assistance and long-term care services, that suddenly jumps up and could be as much as an additional $35,000 a year if you need some more sort of what we call nursing home level of care in the home.
A lot of people here in the state of New Mexico are not at the level where they are able to sustain themselves and get their needs met. What is falling through the cracks? I mean, one hears about, and I've actually met a few people who are always making that choice between food and medicine, or medicine and paying the utility bill and things like that.
So definitely the issue of making a choice of whether you take your medication that day or pay your utility bill, it's very real. What we're hoping to propose out of this initiative are actually some policy recommendations so that we can bridge that gap between what people are actually making and what we think it takes to be economically secure with with programs, maybe that could be some additional housing vouchers for rental assistance. We know that there are waiting lists all over this state for rental assistance vouchers. Or could we fund some more transportation programs, or even supporting our informal caregivers in the home? Because families are the ones where the burden usually falls to be that caregiver, and it takes them away from perhaps having a job, and they're staying at home taking care of an elder.
That's something that other countries actually do, which is there are places where you can get money to help you help an elderly relative.
Yeah, and so one of the policy recommendations is, could we have a tax credit for an informal caregiver who's staying in the home? Or perhaps a community-based program. We already do have some good community-based programs that offer some respite care, but if we could offer more of that and it's more easily accessible in all parts of the state, that would make a big difference in these elders' lives. So we're hoping that this Elder Index, this new tool to measure income adequacy, will be used by policymakers to shape policies moving forward, program planning, advocates that go to the legislature or to their local policymakers to encourage the use of this data in making decisions. And then also, hopefully, it will be used for elders themselves as a retirement planning tool.
Right, right. Now, this whole study in a way that was what they call qualitative as much as quantitative. Describe that process.
Okay, well, the quantitative side, just to note, was done by the University of Massachusetts Boston's Gerontology Institute and a group in D.C., Wider Opportunities for Women. So we were one of 17 states, actually, that are part of this national initiative to get the index developed, the quantitative piece. We decided to complement the quantitative piece with a qualitative, process, but that really meant we wanted
talking to people.
We want to hear the voice of elders, right? Yeah. We want to hear what's important to them around the state. So we worked with Table Women United, and they helped us interview one-on-one some of our Native elders and what economic security meant to them and what was important, what aspects they'd like to see reflected in policies and support for their families. And then also traveled around the state, and we had public deliberations and discussions to learn firsthand about their issues.
What were some of the interesting things that came out of that?
Well, it was great to hear. Sort of, we based it really on what values came out. We wanted to hear, just at a real basic level, what people valued when it came to long-term care and family and caregiving. And we heard independence, aging in place, dignity, choice, connection, family and community, and wellness were sort of the ones that were really highlighted across the whole state.
Aging in place, what does that mean?
Well, we'd like to support people to be able to age in their homes or in their communities if possible. Too often people have to move out of their community and into a nursing home in order to receive that nursing home sort of level of care. And wouldn't it be great if we could provide those same services in the home and everyone had access, not just people who had saved enough for that in retirement, but people who may be on Medicaid or you know, low income.
In order to make that happen, basically, there has to be funding of one kind or another. If a family has enough funding, they can hire people to come into the home. If they don't, they need something else.
That's right. And so a lot of our recommendations are increasing funding to support long-term care. I mean, as we know, as I mentioned earlier, the number of our elders is growing. And so we think at a state level, it's going to be a crisis. And we need to really be supporting those programs for everyone.
We were talking the other day to someone about the mental health system. And when people are mentally ill, so much of the burden goes back onto the family, and the same thing happens with aging.
Yeah.
And if there is no family, then you're even worse off.
That's right. And end up in perhaps a long-term care facility where that individual may not want to be as they age. We do know that actually, unfortunately, caregivers have a high rate of chronic disease, much higher than their counterparts that aren't caring for an elder or you know, a child. And
really? Like what?
Like heart disease, some of the sort of stress-related health issues really are more prominent for caregivers. And we have what we call the sandwich generation. We have a lot of individuals who are still caring for children at home, but then also maybe an elderly adult, a parent or a grandparent.
So, and I dare say a majority of those are women.
Yeah. And, you know, some of the data which was interesting is that women are very much disproportionately impacted and have inadequate income. Social Security, they may not have paid in as much as their male counterpart. And so as we see women age and also live longer, that's a group that needs to be supported.
We're talking to Emily Kaltenbach of the Aging and Long-Term Services Department of the State of New Mexico. Now, does the State of New Mexico, excuse my naivete, but do they have state-run long-term care facilities, nursing homes that people are in?
There are, but most of the long-term care facilities are privately run in New Mexico.
And so when somebody doesn't have the income to go into one of those and pay for it themselves, is there help?
We do have a long-term care system in the Medicaid system that's Human Services Department here in the state, and then also a partner with the Aging Long-Term Services Department. It's called Coordination of Long-Term Services. And so that supports individuals who both receive services in the home but also in institutional setting. Unfortunately, there is a bias still to institutional care, and so that is what we call an entitlement service. So if you're in need of nursing home level of care, you can automatically go into a nursing home. But if you need services in the home and community, there is a huge demand, and there is a registry where you sign up for those services.
And you're not automatically entitled to those. I would imagine that if you did the math, it would probably be cheaper to fund somebody being cared for in their home than being in a nursing home.
Yep. Data shows that, and you know, the jury's still out, but most studies show that it is less expensive to care for someone in their home and community than it is in a nursing home.
Even if you provide nurses and people to drive over there and show up with medicine and stethoscopes and all that stuff.
Yep, for the same level of care. So we're hoping to support an increased sort of focus and funding on home and community-based services.
So how are you hoping to go about that?
Well, you know, we're actively involved on sort of on national discussions of asking the federal government to recognize and support home and community-based services. We advocate for that in our state legislature and at a local level. And actually, I have to note that New Mexico, compared to other states, is ahead of the game in this. We spend, I think we're up in the top five of states that spend most of our long-term care Medicaid dollars towards home and community-based services than towards institutional care. So New Mexico is really a leader in that. But there's still a high demand that we need to meet.
That will be getting higher.
Right.
So in a lot of ways, what you're talking about is really trying to open the ears of policymakers here in the state of New Mexico to look at long-term care in a really future-oriented way and to get citizens, ordinary people who are aging and whose parents are aging and so on, to put the bug in their ear.
Yeah, we hope that our policymakers will look at this new index, the Elder Index as we call it, as a planning tool and a policy development tool. So we urge local and state policymakers to take a look at our new index, which is available on our website. And then also urge our community members to advocate for long-term care services in New Mexico. Because as I mentioned, this is a growing need, and so we hope there's an opportunity to get some advocates out to support aging in place and home and community-based services.
If, let's say, somebody's listening and they want to say, okay, I want to understand this index thing that Emily was just talking about, can they go online and learn about it and read about it?
Yeah, there are a couple places. If you would like to learn about the national initiative and what other states are doing, www.kcmi.gov wowonline.org.
Wowonline.org.
All right. And then our website, www.nmaging.state.nm.us.
Okay.
And so we'll have a link to the Elder Index. And then I'd be happy to give out my phone number, 505-476-4732, if anyone's interested in learning more and would like a copy of the new tool and some of the policy recommendations.
Emily Kaltenbach is with the Aging and Long-Term Services Department of the State of New Mexico. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
I'm delighted now to welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe Bridget Lindquist. She is the executive director of the Española Animal Shelter. And Nina Chiatasso is here. She does community relations with Española Animal Shelter. Welcome, ladies, to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte. Long time no see.
Thank you for having us.
And it's Animal Friday. It's the first Friday of the month. Robert Knott is not with us. And Bill Hutchison is not with us because he has had the audacity to move away. So we thought, all right, let's do Animal Friday with Bridget and Nina. So I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you for having us.
We are
happy to be here too.
So the Española Animal Shelter is yet another wonderful animal welfare institution. And one thing I wanted to really talk about was, what are your lives like? What is your day like? What happens when you come in, let's say yesterday was Thursday, on a Thursday morning, and show up at the animal shelter?
Well, first, there's no average days, so every day brings something new and exciting, for better or for worse. But yesterday, for example, when staff gets there at 8 a.m., the first thing we always do is check the drop boxes, and that's where people are able to leave animals overnight. So we had two dogs and a litter of kittens in our drop boxes, thankfully not in the same box. But
yeah, I was going to say.
And that's, well, believe it or not, that's somewhat unusual.
We get pretty much anything that you can imagine in there. We've had rabbits in there. We've had moms and litters of puppies in with other dogs that are clearly unrelated. We also have meet and greet pens where people are supposed to just meet new animals in those pens, but often we'll find animals left in those pens overnight as well. So the first task of the day always revolves around removing the animals from the drop box, getting them settled in at the shelter. Minutes later, as we were unloading them, somebody brought in a dog who was hit by a car. We do not have a veterinarian there 7 days a week, so it's sort of a triage Peace Corps type process of making sure the animal is comfortable and handled and in a place where we want it to be for the next few days until a veterinarian is able to see it. We had four adoptions first off in the morning, which was wonderful, but the day sort of continued on. We ended up getting 23 animals in throughout the day. If you kind of visualize a shelter, we have 22 dog kennels and 21 cat kennels, so every day, like yesterday, which is kind of our every day, brings a lot more animals than we have space for. So adoptions are always a matter of real pressure for us. Everybody's co-kenneled. There's usually at least one to two dogs in every single cage. So things are very full. It's a matter of constant food and water and walking. And volunteers are a big part of that, but primarily the burden lies on the staff to get those sort of things taken care of.
So co-kenneling means that basically it's like having a college roommate who you don't know, and you're a dog, and this other dog walks in, and not all dogs get along with each other right away.
No. So, and it, I think folks don't realize quite how time-consuming it can be to find a friend for a dog. So it's something that definitely takes up a little bit of our time each day. And not only are you sharing the space with your college roommate, you're also sharing your food. You have to share a bed. You have to share attention. So a girl comes knocking on the door and, oh, hey, how's it going? It doesn't always go over so well because everybody wants the attention of the girl knocking on the door. So in some ways, it's quite a bit like college. usually things resolve themselves. Dogs have a way of working
jail.
It is also a bit like jail. Hopefully, it's a little bit more of a pleasant experience than jail might be for a person. But in all honesty, our shelter, for some animals, is actually the best place they've ever been.
That's right.
A lot of our animals have never been indoors. They've never had regular food or shelter. They've never been out of the rain or had a bed off of the ground. So when they come to the shelter, people say, oh, this is so sad that these animals are here. And you look at the dog, and he's standing there, and he's wagging his tail. He's thrilled. And you say, how is this dog so happy? And it's, these are luxuries to this guy right here. So you can imagine how happy they would be in a home.
Yeah, yeah. So he's saying, I got it made in the shade, and yep. I'm going to charm a new owner.
Yes.
We actually had occasion 4 years ago where some probably well-intended person came to the shelter and broke through all the outdoor dog runs. And their attempt was to free every animal in the place. And they did that the night before. Staffed arrived the following morning only to find all the dogs were still there.
Yeah.
Because what Nina says is true. No matter how desperate their state or how seemingly ideal their state when they arrive, they don't know a leash. They don't know love. Mm-hmm. And so for the short duration of their stay, that's what we're inspired and called to do.
They like leashes?
They don't know what a leash is.
Yeah.
They don't know what, you know, a collar is. And so a big challenge for us is trying to teach these dogs in a fairly short amount of time how to walk amicably alongside a person.
I think there's something that is very important to talk about, which is that a lot of people feel that, and maybe not so much our listeners who are ridiculous animal lovers like me who kiss their dogs on the head every day and things like that.
I like that too.
Like little humans and so on, which may be a good thing and it may be a mental illness, but but there are a lot of people who feel, you know, dogs are an animal. They evolved in nature and they should live a natural life and have a job, which is to guard us or maybe herd cattle or whatever. What's wrong with that way of thinking?
I think the what's most wrong with that way of thinking is that they haven't evolved on their own. We've domesticated them. We've trained them to take on these certain characteristics. That the critical difference between wolves or coyotes and dogs is that dogs have been domesticated. So,
and as for bred.
Yes. Yeah, and deliberately bred to have certain colors, certain traits, certain appearances. And these animals, through our human intervention, have gotten to the state that they are in now. So I think it's just unfair to them to have spent, you know, thousands of years evolving these animals into what they've become, to only abandon them and see them as, you know, assistance to us. I think that we need to see them as more than just working dogs. We need to pay them back for all the good work they do for us.
I think it's also important, from what you're saying, to make distinction between long-haired and short-haired dogs, and think about that respective to the time of year. One of the dogs that I have, the reason I have her is because she belonged to my neighbor, who had three long-haired dogs. Big, fuzzy, winter, warm, long-haired dogs. And this little, tiny Jack Russell Terrier with short hair. And all the dogs were fed out of one bowl, and all of them had to stay outside all the time. And the three long-haired dogs went about their business, and the short-haired dog said, I don't like this, I'm going next door. And she would, every time my front door opened, she went in with it. She was a little sneak dog. And she took up residence on the foot of my bed. And pretty soon was trying to make her way inside because she was cold all the time.
Smart girl.
And she's a very smart dog, and this was over 10 years ago, but one thing led to another, and they moved away and decided to leave her with me, and she became my dog. But she was very unhappy outside in the winter, whereas the other three dogs didn't really seem to mind it that much.
Yeah.
Well, if you think of a dog like a pit bull or a Doberman, these are dogs that traditionally in media and in real life are portrayed as being watchdogs. Outside only, they're the ones who live in the junkyard or on the chain. And with a coat like a pit bull or a Doberman actually has, they're very ill-suited for both high heat and, you know, cold weather, because they don't have thick fur, they don't have fat to insulate them from cold or from overheating. So while these dogs have been portrayed as being these great watchdogs, what's not portrayed is how difficult it really is for them to handle the weather of a place like New Mexico.
I think it's also important when we talk about working dogs, they really have certain basic needs. They need to be out of the sun when it's really sunny. They need to be out of the cold when it's really cold, especially if they have short hair. It's also important to acknowledge that they really love to work.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. The number one breed or mix that we get at the shelter is Australian cattle dogs, so heelers. And people get them, oh, these are these adorable puppies, these little pointy ears, and they are. They're absolutely adorable. I've got one myself, but having one myself, I can also tell you that if the dog doesn't get real exercise and mental stimulation every single day, that it's not a happy animal. You know, they're not a happy pet because they were bred to be so, so active. They're, you know, just going stir crazy. They'll find stuff to do if you don't give them something.
Sometimes you hear about people who are having a hard time getting their dog hiking alongside them, and then they equip them with that backpack and put other water bottles in the backpack, and suddenly the dog is very compliant.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And the key is trying to find the task that really motivates a particular breed of animal. I have a terrier, very high-strung, 45-pound aberrant terrier, who would just run and run and run without any sort of purpose. But that was his, you know, he just wanted to run. So we learned fly ball, we learned frisbee, and I'll be darned if over the course of time, him knowing that that was part of his daily routine, going out, catching frisbee, doing the fly ball, he calmed. Because he felt fulfillment, which is just a really wild thing to see in a dog.
Uh-huh.
I'm fulfilled. I have a purpose. Okay, we can do this maybe once every few days instead of every day, when he was kind of borderline neurotic.
Right, right.
It's really cool. I love that because you see that in humans, too.
Yeah,
humans that are, you know, in a mundane job, not really meeting their talent or their purpose, and have started to check out and misbehave.
Yes.
Not that we employ any of those at Española Valley Humane.
Never.
No, everybody who works at Española Valley Humane Shelter, Humane, what is it called?
Society.
Humane Society.
Humane Society.
Yeah.
So I gotta say the name right. is completely fulfilled.
Well, you know what? They may be fulfilled, but that's not to say that they're not stressed.
Yeah.
So I think that's one of the things
the thing,
that we can take
back
from our dogs.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, it is the work you do, and I commend you both and everybody who works in animal welfare, is incredibly stressful because it never ends.
Right.
You can adopt out 17 animals on a good day, and 23 more come in the next day.
Right.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the things that people say, oh my gosh, I could never work in an animal shelter. I love animals too much. And every time we hear that, we say, no, that hurts our feelings, because we love animals so much that we've put aside how much we love them to be able to save them on a day in and day out basis. But it does. It gets very exhausting. It's emotionally draining. We have, you know, people come in and they want something very specific, and we want to tell them, oh, we've got that for you, but it doesn't look the way they expect it to. You know, they say, I want a dog who's going to be great with my sheep and good with my kids and good with my cats. And we show them, oh, hey, I've got Tiny. Tiny's a 90-pound Rottweiler, and he is sweet as can be. He's a big old teddy bear. And they say, I was thinking more like a terrier. And you think, oh, my gosh, a terrier is not going to be good with your sheep, and it's not going to be good with your children. So you get the stresses from the emotional burden of, like you said, 17 animals get adopted one day and 23 come in the next. But you also get, you know, you're constantly trying to work with people and help people make a good match for the animal's sake, but it doesn't always, it's not as cut and dried as you'd like to think.
So what do you do in a case like that? I mean, you're put in the position of being instant educator / matchmaker.
Yes, and it's tough because I think everybody has a dog in their minds that this is what I really want. You know, as a kid, for some reason, I don't know why, I wanted a basset hound, and I was just set on it. Oh, I have to have a basset hound. And we lived in the city, so we couldn't have a dog. But I swore to myself, the day I got out of college, I was going to get myself a basset hound. And I eventually met somebody who had one. And what a terrible idea that would have been. I mean, they're great dogs for the right person, you know, but they're noisy. And their nose is always to the ground. You know, hounds, you shouldn't really let them off leash. And, you know, I'm very active. I go hiking and running and stuff. And a basset hound would have no interest in keeping up with me. So just, I think people have these ideals of, oh, this is the perfect dog for me and I have to have it. And they don't want to see anything beyond what their ideal is. But the staff spends a lot of time with these animals. There's only about 12 staff to take care of around 4,000 animals a year. So certainly we're spread very thin. But we spend a lot of time with them. You know, every day we're walking through the kennels constantly, cleaning up or feeding or, you know, doing whatever care needs to be done. But we know them. So if somebody says to me, this is what I want, the staff is not just going to try and pawn a dog off on you. We want it to be a dog or a cat who's going to be a good match.
Yeah.
So we do our best we can to sit down and speak with them and say, this is why I think this dog would be a good fit for you. Please spend time with it. And certainly we'll always take an animal back if it doesn't work out. But getting past that initial, this isn't what I had in mind, is our biggest challenge, I think, with matchmaking.
And when you say, trust me on this, I want you to meet little Ralphie here.
Uh-huh.
Do they then usually come around?
I think a good number of people, if you explain to them why you're choosing a specific animal for them, and, you know, they don't say, okay, I recommend, you know, I recommend Ranger. And then the next person that comes in, they hear you saying, oh, you have to go see Ranger, you know. Well, of course, we all have our favorites. But I think part of having a favorite animal at the shelter is recognizing what's going to be the right home for them. So we're not just going to, you know, pawn off any dog on any person that walks in the door. We want it to be a good match. And some people do come around. Some of them still take in their own decision more than they take in our recommendation, and that's fine. I think that folks who are not willing to accept the recommendations of staff as much as others just need to be willing to put in more work. You know, if it's not a perfect match, and nothing's perfect, you know, but if it's not the best match in the world, they need to be willing to take them to puppy classes, even if it's a five-year-old dog, or exercise them a little more than they'd intended to burn off that energy. So if they're willing to take the steps, I think that the match that they choose can be a good match, but there might be a little more work involved.
And we're the fail-safe, too. If for some reason it doesn't work out, we unconditionally accept the animal back. Because we want that animal to be placed well.
Yes.
And we certainly don't want to alienate anyone because of the placement, even if it was something that was motivated by their intention
than
ours.
Absolutely.
But granted, that's a little bit with fear and trembling, because with 4,000 animals coming through a door, sometimes 20 a day, taking an animal you've already seen back is disheartening.
Yeah.
But we try to get that animal in foster care as quickly as possible. The fosters are the best.
Absolutely.
How many reluctant fosters are like, well, I was really hoping to foster a terrier, but instead we give them, you know, a sheepdog or something.
Uh-huh.
And then in the course of that, getting to know the animal, next thing you know, they're adopting him or her.
Or they're finding a home for it. Or they're saying, you know what, next time I'll take whatever you send me. Because this was a good match for me.
I get the personality now. I saw through the exterior a bit.
I always wonder whether foster care is just like a total scam to get unwitting dog loving people to just keep these things forever.
We pray that they don't adopt.
We don't. Yeah.
Everyone in the shelter world, I mean, foster parents are more valuable in many respects than just about anyone else who contributes to our world. Because if they can just house an animal for 2 to 3 weeks, that has such a dramatic impact on his or her personality's temperament and makes them so much more adoptable. And then if they can offer that again the following month, oh my heavens. I mean, they are, we try to appreciate them enough, but it's impossible.
I would say foster parents save more lives for us than any single volunteer or adopter ever could. We have foster parents who, as soon as a litter of kittens is ready to go up for adoption, they say, okay, I'm bringing these in on Tuesday. Can I pick up another litter on Wednesday? And I say, absolutely.
Yeah. And because of our transfer efforts, they also play an instrumental role in preparing those dogs while their vaccinations are being administered. So they have to be fostered for about 3 weeks before they can go up to Colorado. And every year, about 1,100 to 1,200 animals get placed that way. If it wasn't for our foster parents, that program would go by the wayside. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, she's right about how many lives, literally thousands of lives, they save.
I love that there's a transfer program to Colorado. Because their spay-neuter program is so good that they have to import dogs from New Mexico.
Isn't that wild?
It's a phenomenon that's kind of in different parts of the United States. In New England, they have a similar situation as Colorado, where there's a lot of spay-neuter law, and overall the income is higher, so people are more readily able to afford spay and neuter. So they import animals from Georgia and Kentucky quite a bit.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. So it's all over the country. I would love for us to have that problem and need to take in animals from other needy areas. But at this time, we are a sole provider.
Never thought about it that way. That's right.
I wonder if it correlates with the school system ranking. You know, the people who have the best school systems also have the highest rates of spay neuter.
Well, it can't be any coincidence that our schools were on probation for years under the new federal law. And of course there's a correlation. But also, part of it is just, honestly, the heritage that was brought to the area and has existed for, you know, decades and decades. And that was something that was just, it's unique to Española. It doesn't exist in Los Alamos or Taos or Santa Fe. It's a very unique little culture. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of things about it we value, which is why when someone is bringing a dog to us, and clearly that dog has not led a positive life in their care, we try to educate, but most of our time is spent thanking them for the surrender.
Yes.
Because trying to build a bridge of trust between our community and our efforts is huge when there's such a disparity in education, such a disparity in misunderstanding about animal welfare. Just thanking everyone who comes. hoping that our surrender numbers go up over time as our community becomes more trusting.
Absolutely.
We're talking to Bridget Lindquist and Nina Trotasso from the Española Valley Humane Society. I said it correctly this time. You get a lot of animals in. What determines whether an animal is adoptable?
That's tough. There are legal definitions of what adoptable means, and rather than lean on those, because I think in some ways they can be very subjective. So a dog that might guard his food by someone's definition might say is not adoptable. A dog that likes female dogs but not male dogs might be considered not adoptable. A cat that doesn't like to be brushed, someone might consider not adoptable. So
I thought all dogs guard their food.
Yeah. They're dogs, right?
As a matter of fact.
But I think we don't use the term adoptable in the way we release our numbers because I think it's just it's a subjective term for most folks. Rather than deal with that, we just deal with what is a live release rate. So what percentage of the animals that come in leave our shelter alive? And that goes through primarily adoption and transfer options. So what determines which animals leave? A big part of that is who walks into the shelter and wants to take them. So we get a lot of dogs who are heartworm positive or who have treatable injuries or minor behavioral issues. With time, those behavioral issues will often compound and become worse in an animal shelter. If somebody walks in and says, I don't mind that this dog is really high strung and, you know, barks at the fence line and is willing to work with it, if we feel that it's a comfortable, safe match, we're willing to work with that person to help get that animal get placed. But it's a challenge. Who is up for adoption? Unless it's a dangerous animal, everybody is up for adoption. But up for adoption doesn't mean they're all going to get adopted because we need people to walk in the door and help get these animals out alive.
Which is why you've got all these cute little pictures in the paper.
Yes.
Of all the fuzzy little...
We're not shameless. We put on mascara for those dogs if we need
to.
We do whatever we... But, you know, the plight of the pit bulls is a great example. There are some organizations that classify a perfectly healthy little bouncing adolescent pit bull as unadoptable because the breed is banned in Denver in an expanding area and because of the misperception of the breed locally. And they know by classifying that as an adoptable animal, they risk euthanizing a perfectly healthy little bouncy dog.
Right.
We take it on the chin. We acknowledge that we will this year probably put down 120 very, very healthy pit bulls. And as much as we'd love to foster them and care for them and nurture them, there's no place for them to go. And that used to be the case for chows, who you never see in the shelter environment anymore.
Why is that?
Because they were all euthanized.
Oh,
because of
Lord.
The negative perception and, you know, what was perpetuated either through ownership or the media, they were systematically removed. I mean, they're just not part of our intake. It's very rare that we'll see a chow mix today.
Right.
And the shepherds used
There's
to, you know.
There's so many chow mixes in New Mexico.
Yeah.
I see them in the dog park every day.
And thank heavens
and
they are
all
loved.
And they're all named Bear.
Yes, Bear Oso. We get two options.
As an Oso Buco? I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, that's a good example of how eventually pit bulls, too, will be adored and be, you know, good ambassadors for the breed, those who are owned. But in the intervening time, there are a lot being brought to us, and there's not much we can do. And I know that's true for any shelter in New Mexico.
And so you, as a shelter, are put in the incredibly heartbreaking position of euthanizing animals who would be good pets.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's hard because you want these animals to have the best chance. They come to you for a chance, and I think that's one of the, I consider it a blessing that I work with an open admission shelter, and that basically means that every animal that comes to the door, no matter what condition it's in, no matter what behavioral state, if it's physically infirmed, no matter what, we take every single animal in, and everyone gets a chance. So we hope that that we'll give them a chance that ends well for them. And if not, in that time, we give them love and TLC and shelter and food and medical care that they may have never received.
Yeah.
Let's talk about pit bulls for a minute. What's the perception? What's the reality?
I think it really varies by community. You know, we do a humane education program. Our shelter mascot is a pit bull, and she was adopted from our shelter, and she goes to the shelter every day. She has a very important job. And
What's her name?
Her name is Lil, and Lil is... exactly what you see on all the, you know, in all the press for what a scary pit bull looks like. She's a brindle. Her ears have been done, obviously not by us. They were done before she came to the shelter. She is a stocky, solid little dog with a square head and a couple of broken teeth. And but she is the most good-natured dog you've ever met. You know, we took her through therapy dog training, so she's actually a certified therapy dog. She can go into hospitals and schools. She's been certified by the AKC to be a good citizen. And she's a superb dog, and she really is a great example of what pit bulls can be when handled, when raised and handled properly. So she's great with children especially, and that's one of the things that we really look for. But people walk into the door, and she's just laying there in the lobby. She's an unbelievably lazy dog. if somebody walks in the lobby, she'll lift up her head.
It's strange for a terrier.
Yeah. Yes.
It's true.
Yeah, it is. So, but, you know, we appreciate that because, you know, someone opens the door and a little, your typical scruffy terrier might go shooting out the door, and she kind of lifts her head and wags her tail, and you see the people who come in, oh, that looks just like my brother's dog. That's a great dog. Or you get the people who literally stop at the door and point and try and tell us to move the dog so that they'll come in the door.
Oh, wow.
Okay. So, and which for us, you know, as sad as it is that, you know, the dog who works at the shelter as her full-time job that she loves to have, you know, she's being asked to move, but it's a great educational opportunity for us to explain to them, you know, this dog is one county fair ribbon. She's able to go into hospitals or nursing homes. She's able to work with, you know, mentally challenged children. And little by little, the community, I think, will start to accept it. But it takes a million lils to make up for one dog who was intact, so not neutered, running loose, broke free of his train for the first time and bit somebody. So, and it's just, it's tragic. So,
well, and a common misperception here in Santa Fe, correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, you've got an ambassador like Lil who's bomb-proof around people. Mm-hmm. And people say, well, I could just let her be with my other pets, my mm-hmm. other dogs. But Nina takes the time to separately kennel Lil every time she leaves the house. Why do you mm-hmm. do that?
I think that there's a lot of precautions that you need to take with any breed. You know, if I had a pet greyhound, I wouldn't let it loose around my pet rabbit. You know, and pit bulls, although they're superb with humans, and even those who are bred to be the best so-called fighting dogs had to be bred to be wonderful with people so that the people could pull them apart while fighting.
Right.
They can still often have some dog aggression. So I would never want to put my dog in that issue.
So basically they're bred to have dog aggression. So
they were bred for dog aggression.
Yeah.
So currently, very few pit bulls are actually bred for fighting. It's a tiny, tiny minority, just like very few German shepherds are actually bred to herd sheep, which is what they were initially bred for. So
right, now they're bred for hip dysplasia.
Right.
There you go.
Exactly.
You go.
So it's just, I mean, you have to look at what a dog was initially bred for and what has been bred out of it. So,
but, I mean, our pit bull, let's say I go adopt a cute little, I love pit bulls.
Yes.
I think they're the cutest thing ever. But I've never had one. Uh-huh. So let's say I go adopt one and it's a puppy and I bring it home and it interacts with my terriers and dachshund. Do I have to be scared that when it grows up to be four times their size, that it will attack them?
I wouldn't say be afraid of it. I would just say be aware of what a dog is capable of. And anytime you have a large breed dog around small breed dogs, it's something you should be aware of, that if a scuffle over a treat goes bad, the big dog is going to win. So with a pit bull, you just need to be aware of that these dogs do have a possibility of dog-to-dog aggression. What you also need to be aware of is that dog-to-dog aggression is a major, majorly different category than human aggression. So even if a pit bull doesn't like other dogs, if it gets along well with your dogs, it may not get along well with dogs outside of its so-called pack.
Yeah.
So it's so, so important to socialize these dogs with other dogs as young as possible and continue doing it throughout their lives, because a dog reaches sexual maturity around the age of 3. And so even if it's spayed or neutered, that's when it kind of comes into its own. So you can get a puppy.
Dating.
Yeah, exactly. Staying out late. All the stuff you don't want them doing.
Getting drunk.
Stealing the car.
Take a more rawhide than it knows what to do with. So,
do we anthropomorphize dogs? Yeah. Oh, no.
Never. Never.
Well, and all of this wisdom you're dispensing about pit bulls applies to so many other breeds.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's why I just think the pit bulls are really woefully misrepresented in that their weaknesses are exaggerated. You know, a pit bull snaps at someone, they know about it in the Australian press. Mm-hmm. If, you know, even if a German Shepherd or a lab mauls someone, it's probably just a local event. So there's a lot of things that are factoring in to this misrepresentation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But we'll, you know, it'll work out over time.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they also, there's a score called the American Temperament Test, and it's a standardized set of testing.
Yeah.
American Pit Bull Terriers, which is an actual breed, whereas Pit Bull in media terms actually relates to a whole bunch of different breeds. The American Pit Bull Terrier actually scores higher than Golden Retrievers on a temperament test. And that has to do with generalized behavior. So general handleability, reaction to strangers, fear over various situations. Somebody approaches the owner, what does the dog do? They pass with an 86.8% pass rate. So it's pretty remarkable. If you actually look at, presumably those are the people who are raising their dogs properly, this is how many of them are actually passing a temperament test.
We're talking to the good folks from the Española Valley Humane Society. So what happens when somebody comes in and says, I want to adopt a dog, and I'm going to put it on a chain and leave it outside?
They don't adopt a dog. It's very straightforward. I think there's, of course, people who are going to lie or be dishonest about the situation. We do have the allies of animal control to go out and visit the property if we really feel that maybe this is a good person, maybe they're not. But if an animal is going to be adopted, one of the questions on the questionnaire is, where is it going to sleep and is it going to live, is it going to be chained or tethered? And if they ever say the animal's going to be chained or tethered, then, again, it's an opportunity for education. I think that often, those of us who let their dogs sleep in their bed and kiss them on the head every day don't think of it, but so often people just don't realize that life on a chain is not the way for a dog to live. So if you talk to them about why that might be depressing or distressing, when we go to the schools, I ask the kids, what do you do if your dog is naughty? And invariably one of the children will say, I tie it up outside. So what we do is we take Lil, our pit bull mascot dog, and tie her to the doorknob, and she just sits there and sulks and sulks for the rest of the class. And I said, all right, let's go outside. And the kids will say, well, what about the dog? I said, well, don't you leave your dog chained up? And you see the light bulbs go off.
Yeah.
Kids realize. So there is a way to reach them, and it's not by judgment. So you need to just talk to folks. But we won't send a dog to a home where knowingly it's going to be chained.
And we cared enough about that that we lobbied the city council and got an ordinance enacted that made that illegal. So it's illegal to chain your dog in the city limits of Española.
Is it enforced?
Rarely. But
it can be.
It can be, and there's just something endemic about, the city that makes that more difficult. But, baby steps. We'll start with baby steps. It's an easier default for us to say, actually, you may not realize this, but chaining's illegal. Here's some other options to that. How can we help facilitate, your adoption of this dog?
Right. And that doesn't mean that you have to go as far as other people go, which is having the dog inside your house all the time and treating it as if it were your biological child.
Yes.
So you have something coming up, which I want to make sure we talk about, even though it's not for another month. It's a fundraiser on Tuesday, the 5th of October, for the Española Valley Humane Society.
Every year we raise about 8 to 10% of our annual budget in a single night. And this year it'll be on Tuesday, October 5th. The Children's Museum here in Santa Fe is so kind to host, and we're billing it a grown-ups night at the Children's Museum. It's just a set time from 6 to 9 p.m.
All human grown-ups, no dogs.
No dogs, and maybe next time. We used to have dogs at our events, and we found that, honestly, it's kind of like bringing your children along. It distracts your attention, and it makes it more difficult to focus on that mass array.
Well, it's all about I go to the barking ball every year, and I love it, but it's all about the dogs.
It is.
And gosh bless them, I wish we were in a position where we didn't need to raise money, but that's our primary focus for the evening. So we'll have silent auctions, live auctions, a special appeal moment where we really tell you more about our mission in a way that resonates for most people who come. But we're already receiving amazing donations. We have this incredible telescope that a gentleman donated. We have a bedroom ensemble, Posh by Gosh, donated. And the candy man came through with a guitar.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Fabulous guitar.
With all the fixins.
All set up.
So that's the kind of stuff you're going
like
to get to see.
Like an electric guitar?
Like an electric Fender. Can you even believe
no.
it?
No!
Well, I guess we can count you in. If you want to learn more, we have a newly introduced website at evalleyshelter.org, and the event details are there.
evalleyshelter.org. Bridget Lindquist, the wonderful executive director, Nina Trotasso, community relations person, Española Valley Humane Society. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe radio cafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.